How would you rate your sound health and why?
Oh man. I would say I'd give myself like a B because
Well, if we're talking about like a school grading scale, I would probably give myself a B.
I think it's pretty good. I'm actually a musician and I also have perfect
I
pitch.
love sports, and so to me it's like all about kind of the feel that sound brings to those things, and I can't imagine diminishing that. It's probably because I was an athlete and I get it. Like it's the thing that pumps you up, you know, it gets you going for the game. And so why would you want to diminish that feeling?
I think I would probably grade my sound health as pretty good. I think I do suffer from the Gen Z millennial concept of listening to loud music, and I think that that hasn't helped me.
Welcome to Amateur Hour, brought to you by BrainVolts.
In this episode, you'll hear from me, Mia.
And me, Stephanie.
As we explain what we've learned in our class, biological foundations of speech and music. You'll also be hearing from a handful of our peers who we've interviewed for this piece, and a special guest or two.
Today, this amateur professional of sound is asking, what is the relationship between sound and our overall health?
Do you mean mental health? Physical health?
All of it. Sound has a profound impact on so many aspects of our overall health. In this episode, we'll look at the existence of sound-related injuries and sound processing impairments, as well as how sound can enrich our everyday health.
What exactly is the relationship between sound and our overall health?
And why should it matter? Who should it matter to?
Consider this. Music matters to a lot of people. Is there a connection between music and our brain's health?
And we all probably know someone who is bilingual or multilingual. What effect does knowing more than one language have on the hearing brain?
What happens to the hearing brain as we age?
Do you ever hear a ringing sound, but you can't find anything around you that could be causing it?
Should we be worried about our hearing after a traumatic brain injury like a concussion?
It sounds like we have a lot of questions to answer, so let's dig in.
Let's start out by talking about noise.
Noise? Well, we hear noise everywhere. It's inescapable.
Oh, sure. Noise is everywhere. In traffic, in the grocery store, in our workplaces. It can be hard to tune out.
We all know that sudden loud noises can be bad for our ears, but how does moderate everyday noise affect our hearing?
That depends. Sound processing abilities vary from person to person. Different people actually have varying abilities to hear speech and noise, and that's something we have to consider when we evaluate sound processing impairments and hearing loss.
So when you talk about sound processing and noise, you're talking about our ability to separate the important sounds, like someone talking to you in a restaurant, or a car honking at you in a parking lot, from sounds that aren't as important, basically just background noise?
That's right. But there are instances where it's really hard for some hearing brains to separate those important sounds from the noise, despite having normal hearing. And it has a lot to do with the noise itself. It's also true that some people with technically good hearing can still report having a hard time hearing speech and noise.
So is there a particular kind of noise that interferes with our ability to hear speech?
Well, first there are noisy environments and room variables like acoustics. Right now, you're hearing me in pretty ideal circumstances. But now imagine how hard it would be to understand what I'm saying in a noisy coffee shop or standing at opposite ends of a tunnel.
Right, those are tricky environments for hearing.
And then there are components of the speech itself that can make it hard to hear, like fast-paced speech, competing speech, which is speech that overlaps the speech you actually want to hear, or speech that gets interrupted.
I'm guessing that it's pretty common to struggle with separating speech from noise then, right? Those are a lot of variables that can make it challenging.
Totally. There are some circumstances that make it difficult for anyone to hear the important sounds in an environment, but a person's ability to hear speech and noise is also related to their overall sound health. We know that our ability to hear speech and noise declines as we age. But it's not just aging that impacts how we hear a noise. Injuries such as concussions can make it even more difficult to hear speech and noise. There's actually lots to learn about the relationship between concussions and sound processing in general.
Yikes. Well, aging is inevitable. Is there anything we can do to strengthen our hearing and noise ability even as we get older? Or if our brains suffer damage from an injury?
Music. People who regularly play music have a stronger ability to hear speech and noise than people who don't. The ability is heightened by the stronger harmonics and timing tracking seen in musicians' hearing brains.
A great reason to train your brain with music.
Definitely. But I'm interested in hearing more about how hearing is impacted by injury, like concussions.
When I think about concussions, I usually think of blurry vision or dizziness. Sound processing changes aren't really top of mind, but testing the auditory brain after concussion can indicate the extent of the damage.
Ah, sound and overall health. There it is.
Yes, we could use sound to identify the severity of the concussion, and we could use ongoing testing to help determine when the patient might be ready to return to work, school, or sports.
Yeah, my name is Riley Corcoran. I am a second-year Doctor of Audiology student at Northwestern University. I suffered from a traumatic brain injury my junior year of high school. In the high school, I played soccer for a traveling soccer league in the summers, and I was running up on the ball, and I tripped and fell. And when I fell, I not only hit my head on the ground, but the goalie came out, and we collided, and it was a whole mess. And so that was when I first knew I had a concussion, because it was a very traumatic experience. But I didn't realize the lasting effects and all of the different symptoms I would have. I actually ended up being in recovery for about 9 months. And a lot of the therapies I needed, I had no idea that they would last so long.
You know, I had a concussion when I was really young, around 5 years old. I had some dizziness and amnesia, as well as the difficulty hearing in noisy environments, but I know next to nothing about what was happening to my auditory brain. Can you talk me through auditory impairments from a concussion and how they happen?
Well, the hearing brain is vast. The auditory system connecting the ear and brain has more relays than any other sensory system. Relays are a type of neuron that helps others communicate. Each relay has an axon, which is the slender fibrous part of the relay.
Hang on. Relays, axons, what's going on here?
Picture the hearing brain as a tiny marble track. The relay neurons are the marbles, and the axons are the track that the marbles roll through to get from point A to point B. The relay neurons, or the marbles, are always carrying auditory signals to sensory and motor neurons throughout the brain.
And the axons are the track in this scenario? You could have a ton of marbles, but without the track, those marbles aren't getting where they need to go.
That's right. The concussive injuries are believed to be especially damaging to those axons, basically removing that track that carries relay neurons to the parts of the brain that give them meaning.
What happens to our ability to hear when those axons are damaged?
Sound processing is normally 1,000 times faster than visual processing. Our axons need to work fast to make that happen. But damage to the brain can disrupt the microsecond level temporal precision that we use to encode sound in the brain. Maybe the axon marble track isn't totally missing, but a concussion could mean that it's suddenly bumpy, bent, or has some gaps. The relay neuron marbles will be slowed down or completely impeded, so a lot of meaning gets lost from the sound input.
Sure. You could have a million of those relay neuron marbles, but they need fast axon tracks to get to the parts of the brain that translate the sonic input into meaning. What other auditory injuries or impairments can result from a concussion?
Well, there's the possibility of perforating the eardrum. Then there's tinnitus, a persistent sound of ringing in the ears. There can be temporary or permanent changes in our hearing threshold. Basically, hearing loss or a shift in hearing sensitivity. And don't forget earaches.
Yeah, so the first symptom, I think, from the onset of the injury, I lost consciousness and I felt, I was really nervous about being paralyzed. I couldn't feel my arms or legs for an extended period of time. And I don't remember the incident at all. So a lot of the things that I will share with you today are just from people who took care of me and were able to share those stories with me. But a lot of the symptoms changed over time. The initial ones where I had to relearn how to read, how to walk, I was in physical therapy for a while, and a lot of it was light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, and a lot of fatigue, because people don't realize that your brain is injured, and so it needs sleep as a way to recover. And so I ended up going to school half days my entire junior year. Yeah, so one of the biggest things I struggled with was memory. My short-term memory was off. My mom would have a conversation with me and about an hour later be like, oh, what about this thing? She's like, we just talked about this. And so there were things that I would do in my daily life that just didn't make sense and they weren't me. So I was in, they call it vision therapy. And so that's kind of helping the muscles in my eyes get more used to tracking for reading and moving from things that are close up to far away. And so I was in therapies for PT and vision. And one of the things they don't tell you about having a brain injury is the mental and emotional impact. So although I had a lot of physical symptoms, there was a lot of like depressive episodes and things that aren't accounted for. My mom always talks about that time period as she wondered if she ever would get her daughter back. I didn't see it myself in the moment.
Wow. So a concussion can have lots of potential impacts on sound processing. Does that mean there's a way to identify whether or not a patient has had a concussion just by looking at their auditory system?
Yes, we can find auditory deficits in concussed patients by testing their frequency following response, or FFR for short.
Hi, my name is Victoria Frank. I am in the Doctorate of Audiology program at Northwestern University. So the acronym FFR is frequency following response.
And it is an objective measure that can be used to look at the neural synchrony and neural firing of the brain in response to sounds, to different stimuli, and how different external factors might impact the anatomical and physiological function.
This measurement is important because it gives us an idea of how reliable our system is at locking onto the phase of a stimulus.
We can test a concussion patient's FFR to monitor healing and help decide when it is appropriate for them to return to school, sports, or work, because the FFR strength returns to normal when concussion symptoms are alleviated.
That's something that they don't tell you, is it's so individualized, how hard you hit your head, where you hit your head, how you're going to respond to treatment. And so I was hopeful that, oh, I'll just be back in school and at sports in a week, not realizing that I would be out and my life would be impacted for about 9 months. And I ended up having to go to like a specialty concussion clinic in my local area, which I was really grateful that they had this resource. But my treatment got to the point where it needed to be more specialized. And so, yeah, you don't realize the impact that it can have on each person.
So we mentioned that tinnitus can result from a concussion. Can we uncover more about what tinnitus is, how it's diagnosed, and how it can be treated?
Sure. Concussions can cause tinnitus, but it's also possible to have tinnitus without a concussion. When we think of tinnitus, or tinnitus, it's pronounced both ways, we commonly think of a ringing tone that's just happening in a person's head. That might sound like this. There's also a buzzing tinnitus and a roaring tinnitus.
Those are all examples of subjective tinnitus, meaning that they are heard internally, right? So what's going on inside a person's head to create these sounds?
Tinnitus is caused by a change of input from the ear to the brain. The most common change happens in the hair cells within the cochlea, often due to noise exposure.
I'm Dan Cruz. Fairly recently, I've been noticing that my hearing's been going, I think it's mostly because of like the restaurants that I've been working in. They like pump in a lot more music, like a lot louder music, because they're trying to have this hip vibe. After work, I've noticed like a lot, like ringing in my ears for sometimes, you know, hours after work, which is a little alarming. It varies actually. It's never the same. But it is like a high-pitched, almost like buzzing, like, you know how like computer buzzes? Like it's just this continuous, like almost like electrical sound. Sometimes it gets a lot louder, sometimes it's quieter. Sometimes it's just like a burst as well, like a burst of sound, and then it just stops.
Okay, it sounds like hearing loss is a common cause of tinnitus.
Exactly. Now, there are cases where someone has chronic tinnitus that doesn't coincide with hearing loss. In these cases, instead of losing hair cells in the cochlea, there has been a loss of connections between the cochlear hair cells and the brain. This is called deafferentation.
Whoa, deafferentation. Shout out to the afferent system. We talked about this in our first episode. The afferent system is basically responsible for signaling inputs into the hearing brain for processing. So I could imagine how deafferentation could cause problems for the auditory pathway. The neurons involved might sense that they need to compensate for the low signal coming from the cochlea to the brain.
Yep, and the neurons do this by increasing their sensitivity. Imagine that you're expecting to hear sound coming through your headphones, but you don't hear anything from them. You might try turning up your headphones as loud as they'll go to try to boost the sound you're expecting to hear. And you'd end up hearing that buzzing electronic interference, which you'd normally be able to ignore. That's what neurons are doing in a hearing system that is struggling with tinnitus.
So if I turn up my headphones all the way, I get that annoying electronic buzzing noise. When the brain turns the signal all the way up where there's no sound, the brain ends up just receiving more neural noise, neurons firing away spontaneously and working to make sense of the noise, even when there isn't an incoming sound to begin with?
You got it. Auditory pathway neurons respond by synchronizing with that missing manufactured frequency, even though they aren't actually receiving that input, which perpetuates the sense of ringing or buzzing in the ear.
This is starting to sound like a phantom limb. When the brain senses that it's missing an input, it tries to amplify and replicate the input it's expecting. Amputees often express the sensation that an amputated or missing limb is still attached, so they have the feeling of a phantom limb.
It's fairly similar. These neurons don't just synchronize to the missing frequency, but they also go searching for it. The other neurons nearby join in on the search, and soon those neurons are all occupied with finding and amplifying the missing frequency. The limbic system, the part of the brain involved in emotion and behavior, responds by focusing more attention on the phantom sound from the tinnitus. In a healthy hearing brain, the efferent system, the pathway from the brain to the ear, would step in and cancel out this pay more attention signal from the limbic system. But in a damaged hearing brain, the signal to pay more attention would not be inhibited, so that sense of buzzing or ringing becomes pretty inescapable, even though it's all technically just happening in the person's own head.
It is fairly random, but I know that it happens a lot right after I'm done with my shift. It's like 50-50. Like, sometimes it's like I could be sitting there reading, and then all of a sudden it gets so loud, like the ringing in my ears gets so loud, I can't even focus on reading.
That sounds really difficult to deal with. Now that we know what it is, how do we treat it?
Well, the treatment most commonly used is CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy. CBT can help people with tinnitus learn to regulate the emotions and attention that their limbic system pays to tinnitus.
Huh? So it's less about getting rid of the tinnitus and more about coping with having tinnitus?
It's starting to make me realize that I'm getting older. For sure. Like, it's, I don't know, once you hit 30, you're like, all of a sudden you're like, yeah, everything's breaking. And it's just so your hearing goes, you know, your back hurts all the time. So realizing that you got to take more care of yourself and actually be kind to your body. Because once something goes, it's gone.
So let's recap. Firstly, we lose our ability to hear speech and noise as we age to a certain degree, but there is hope. There are several ways to strengthen our auditory systems.
Secondly, concussions can disrupt our auditory system by destroying some of the connections in our brain. But examining that auditory system post-concussion can give us a better idea when it is safe to go back to work or play. And tinnitus is our brain's response to missing hair cells and frequencies. With tinnitus, learning to regulate our emotional response and focus is the best practice.
Now that we know some injuries and sound processing impairments that are associated with overall health, it makes me wonder what can be done to enhance our overall health through sound.
What about music therapy?
Most of us know just from our personal experiences that music can get us moving, enhance our moods, and even spark certain memories.
Some of my favorite memories are associated with different songs, and some of my least favorite ones?
Me too.
Music has an extremely tight link to our memories.
Right, but why exactly is that?
Evolutionarily, animals needed to know what sounds were associated with predators and with food.
So, biologically, humans have evolved to link the hearing system to memory?
Sure. Music engages the vast sound brain to combine the auditory aspects of the motor, sensory, cognitive, and reward systems.
Right, so it helps us to think, move, sense, and to feel? But is there actually a science behind the use of music to improve our overall health?
Yes. Since the modern-day human doesn't need to stress as much about being eaten by predators, our links from music to memory are, simply put, generally more focused on thriving than surviving. But still, listening, performing, and creating music involves intricate circuitry of our brains, which serves, in part, to lock music into our memories.
And this can be harnessed into our daily lives through health and wellness applications?
Exactly. Music therapy can be used for a lot of the neurological disorders we mentioned earlier, especially in rebuilding memory. It can also be used to help enable nonverbal patients with Alzheimer's or dementia recall memories using a song from their past, or even revitalize the auditory pathways, enabling them to sing. Similarly, it can help some people with damage to the frontal lobe of the brain, which causes loss of language, a disorder called Broca's aphasia, speak more fluently too.
Wow, are there any other methods that work similarly to improve our health?
Rhythm learning can help.
Is rhythm learning what it sounds like? Just the basic technique of counting out rhythms?
Yes, but it's not something only found in music, which we most often associate it with. From the tides to rocking babies, rhythm surrounds us and is a part of everything we do, including language and speech, which we talked about on our last episode.
So there is a relationship between rhythm and hearing. Are our brains automatically sensitive to sounds and their rhythms?
Absolutely. Rhythm plays a large role for the auditory motor connection. It's the auditory motor connection that lets you dance to a beat or simply tap your foot along to a tune. Rhythm therapy has been used to help patients in the military recover from traumatic brain injuries.
Given the auditory motor connection, I'd guess that rhythm learning and music can be used in athletics for various movement rehabilitations. Is that right?
That's correct. Sound therapies have been known to have a positive impact in helping athletes, both healthy athletes and those affected by neurological disorders or physical injury. One example is using bone vibration, which can include patients using small vibrating tools on specific areas of injury or whole body vibration treatment to encourage healing after injuries like fractures and sprains. Or tone therapy, which is using special sounds to help listeners to quickly feel relieved from stress or anxieties. Think of it as sound meditation, which athletes can use to get them in the right headspace before an event.
Cool. Another common area where rhythm learning and music therapy offer benefits is with individuals diagnosed with autism. A common symptom of autism is having the ability to understand what you say, but not how you say it. The music of speech, namely your intonation and rhythm, carries a lot of your intent.
There's this experiment that assessed the ability of children to synchronize to a steady beat. The results demonstrated that the kids who could synchronize with the beat typically had stronger language skills than the kids who struggled to synchronize with the rhythm. So, practicing with music and rhythm can ultimately help a person with autism communicate and connect. In fact, language is so tied to rhythm that even babies babble in the rhythmic patterns of their native tongue. Speaking of language, aren't there some benefits associated with brain health and bilingualism?
Yes, bilingualism's effect on the brain's structure and functions depend on a number of factors, including the age of acquisition along with one's proficiency in the language.
What are some of these benefits?
There are many benefits to bilingualism, including a stronger ability to learn other languages, clearer recognition of patterns, better neural response to speech, and better executive control and attention. Bilinguals are also better than monolinguals at detecting tones and noise.
My name is Libby Lessenhop.
I was six. My family moved to Brazil on my sixth birthday. So I started learning Portuguese pretty much as soon as I turned six, and especially learned through watching TV in our hotel before we found our house. That was a real immersion practice, and also just being around only Portuguese speakers. Early in life, fluency is a big part of who I am, I think, but we moved back, and I started learning Spanish because they don't teach Portuguese in public schools, you know, and I knew I wanted to keep learning languages, but I really wanted to keep up with Portuguese. So I ended up studying it in college again, which was my first opportunity after moving back to the United States. Spanish was easy to grasp because of the structure and because it's both are Romance languages. So unlike English, like generally the pronunciation is pretty consistent and even a lot of spelling is the same. That presented more challenges in college when I studied both. I would go between my Spanish and Portuguese classes with just 30 minutes between them. And I would just have like marble mouth for the first half hour of whichever class was second, because I would be kind of just fully focused on reading sometimes the same words, but with totally different pronunciation. That was definitely challenging. But when I was learning Spanish, it just felt like I was receiving the language in a different way than those who were learning a second language for the first time, because so much of the language does overlap.
Detecting tones and noise? That would definitely be useful when speaking tonal languages. Are there any disadvantages to being bilingual?
In a way, a bilingual's vocabulary in both languages can sometimes be more limited than a monolingual person's vocabulary, despite knowing more words than a monolingual. This is because bilinguals have multiple words for one concept. However, a multilingual person can strengthen their vocabulary in more than one language if they make the effort to do so.
I see. And what's up with a bilingual's ability to detect sentences and noise? How is this different from being better at detecting tones and noise?
While we determined earlier that musicians are better at speech perception and noise than non-musicians, a bilingual person is often worse at hearing sentences and noise in comparison to monolinguals.
Why is that?
This is likely because bilingual speakers are required to manage two separate linguistic systems, which means they're switching between these two languages on a regular basis.
How exactly does a bilingual speaker's brain work? Is there always some level of brain activity happening in both languages when thinking or speaking?
If you think of a person's language fluency as a hard drive, a bilingual is always going to have both hard drives running, even though they're likely to only be engaging with one language at a time.
So in bilinguals, even when the second language isn't being used, they will still activate it during communication? Even if the speaker isn't using the language aloud?
Exactly. It's never really turned off.
I don't know if I am getting older or if I've always struggled with that. I'm definitely sensitive to noise, like sound. I get very, very overwhelmed at the grocery store, for example. I also think that I like am always hoping to hear Portuguese, and so I definitely like phantom it.
Does being bilingual help any of the sound-related health impairments we mentioned earlier?
Bilingualism can actually help to delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease symptoms.
Why does bilingualism help protect against this disease more than monolingualism?
Bilinguals use areas of the brain that work with controlling key neural networks. This increased connectivity in certain areas of their brain ultimately works to help protect them from Alzheimer's.
So, bilinguals exercise the same parts of the brain that monolinguals use, only more intensely and regularly, as well as using parts of the brain that require different neural activity from monolinguals?
Yes, and by building these strong brain connections, bilingual brains are better able to cope with damage to the brain before they start displaying outward signs of Alzheimer's.
So, bilingual people's brains are found to be more resilient to dementia caused by Alzheimer's disease?
Correct. Bilinguals simply possess certain auditory processing advantages that help them to perform better than monolinguals in everyday life, listening to everyday settings in life that are unique to their experiences.
So, to summarize, bilinguals might have a harder time understanding language in noisy environments, and potentially could have a smaller vocabulary in the languages they speak. However, those downsides are countered with better executive control of their attention, the ability to more quickly form a sound-to-meaning connection, and a stronger ability to recognize patterns.
Yes, bilingual speakers generally have an easier time with learning a third language than a monolingual has with learning a second language. Well, now that we know about some injuries, processing impairments, and enhancements to our health created by sound, why does it all matter?
When it comes to the brain and our overall health, sound has a huge part in our daily interactions, learning, and functioning, especially in our somatosensory systems.
The somatosensory system provides perceptions related to touch and our physical contact with the world around us. It includes our perceptions of touch, pressure, temperature, pain, and position in space.
Evolutionarily, this might be incredibly important for our survival.
Yes, our perception of speech, music, and language is tied into these systems because sound affects our peripheral and neural systems as well as our brain plasticity.
Brain plasticity.
Brain plasticity is simply the ability of the brain's neural structures to grow and reorganize.
How do these changes occur?
The changes can range from an individual neuron pathway developing new connections to entire systemic adjustments like cortical remapping.
What is cortical remapping?
Every part of our bodies is connected to a corresponding part in the brain, which creates something we call a cortical map. Cortical remapping is when our brain is prompted by a stimulus to reorganize an existing cortical map into a new one.
What type of stimulus can prompt this change?
Cortical maps change in response to both deprivation and enrichment. For example, artists who have suffered some kind of injury and must learn to paint in unconventional ways develop unique and precise cortical maps based on the limbs they use to create their art. This remapping of the brain, based on the new physical functioning of the body, works similarly for individuals with phantom limbs.
So, the motor and somatosensory cortices are highly interactive and can work together in a way that creates unwanted symptoms as well?
Yes, motor information is ultimately controlled by these maps. The overuse or repetitive stress of one's hand or other limbs can lead to an injury because the plasticity of the motor maps, not the biomechanical stress to the area.
This is called RSI, or repetitive strain injury, which is also known as the yips, right? I've heard these are common in musicians and athletes. Can they be treated?
They can be treated by changing the relationship between the peripheral and central nervous systems, or essentially changing the nature of the input to the cortical map.
Does tinnitus work similarly in regards to reorganizing cortical maps?
Because tinnitus is generated by brain plasticity gone awry, these same mechanisms can be harnessed to reverse the perception. An experiment shows that targeted training and stimulation triggers the limbic system to help cope with the symptoms of pathological tinnitus.
Do these map changes occur in the auditory system?
Profound auditory deprivation or deafness can induce cortical remodeling of auditory and visual areas. This plasticity affects both the auditory system and the visual system. There's also tremendous auditory integration in music. If you imagine music without even listening to it or playing it, your auditory system will be engaged. The mental practice of imagining playing a piece of music, even if you're standing still, activates the motor system.
So, motor parts subliminally move in sync with what you're listening to because there's a deep connection between the motor system and movement and hearing?
Exactly. Many people don't realize it, but maintaining our sound health is just as important as the rest of our minds and body's health, and we should regularly be thinking about how to enrich it.
Our physical health is actually intertwined with our sound health and auditory systems.
Yes, our motor, auditory, and somatosensory systems all work together to ultimately help us to fully experience the world around us.
Coming from someone who is very interested in pediatrics, I think exposing babies and young children to environments that are rich in sound is critical. So then they're developing that sound meaning connection of, oh, that is the door slamming.
I would say just identifying those places where you are in loud environments and making sure that you're protecting your hearing. I think it's also really important that we teach kids what is noise and what are loud environments like, and what can they do to protect their own hearing and advocate for themselves in those situations.
The first and biggest thing that I will say is definitely exercise.
In your settings on your phone, you can control the maximum output for the speaker on your phone as well as the headphones. And just reducing it the max output by half is all that you really need to do. That will definitely help conserve hearing.
So what is the biggest takeaway from all of this?
A big one is the interconnectedness between sound and health of the systems within our body. Nothing works in isolation.
Though we may not realize it, each system has its own functions and strengths, and is all closely tied together.
Yes. Also, we can learn about plasticity to better understand the brain's natural inclination to fix itself. And we can develop our own strategies to help enrich it. So we should encourage the development of treatments, enrichments, and therapies through sound.
Basically, all the systems in the body are interconnected through both music and movement, which can reorganize our reward system and restructure the way we view other aspects in our lives. Our brain can be impaired by sound, but it can be enhanced by sound too. Though each person's hearing brain is different based on their own life experiences, there are ways to protect and enrich our lives in sound.
This episode was produced by Libby Lessenhop, Mia Reggie,
Stephanie Condon, and Felicia Dominguez.
Amateur artists, professional students.
Using sound to better understand science.
Thanks to Riley Corcoran, Victoria Frank, Aaron Schomler, Caden Washington, Antonia Young, Dan Cruz, Dr. Neil Verma, Shevnam Dundar, Bree Chiapetta, Dr. Jen Chrisman, Dr. Nina Krause.
Music by Blue Dot Sessions and Libby Lessenhop.